Thanks. Please be seated.
Welcome to the Arizona Court of Appeals, where we are here this morning on oral argument in the matter Weber versus Weber, and which is our case number CACV 25-1025. As you probably know, we have these things up on YouTube for others to look at in real time or later. So when you step up to the podium, please state your name and the name of your client. You have a maximum of 20 minutes per side. You're not required to use all of your time. If appellant says, you know, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, we'll do our best to help with that. But ultimately, that's your thing to kind of keep track of and manage. Please keep in mind that we have read your briefing, we have studied the record, and we have discussed the case in conference actually yesterday afternoon and this morning both. So we are ready to hear from you on whatever you'd like to discuss with us. So appellant, please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you and good morning. Michael Ellsworth on behalf of the appellant, Justin Weber. When I started practicing a little over 23 years ago, we didn't have the Arizona Rules of Family Law Procedure. Shortly thereafter, though, I think 2006, January is when those rules went into effect. Then we had initially with those rules, that Rule 69 just mentioned finding agreements would be in writing. I think we realized pretty shortly that that was going to be problematic. There were changes in 2011 to that rule. And then in 2009 is when we adopted the current rule, which has the language that it's in writing and signed by the parties or their attorney with that. So really the issue today, and as we stated in our briefing, is appellant has never said that email communication can't be a Rule 69 agreement. It can be. Appellant hasn't said that an electronic signature can't be considered a signing by a party or the attorney and can be a binding agreement. Really, the issue today is really very limited to the fact that in the communication between myself and Mr. Hope, in my communication, there was the language that was included in that that clearly stated that the communication does not constitute an agreement pursuant to Rule 69 of the Arizona Rules of Family Law Procedure.
And Mr. Ellsworth, yeah, and we've read it, and I think we all have it in front of us.
Yes.
I'm curious about it. So, you know, I've worked in private law firms before I was a judge, and sometimes you have these signature blocks, and they have disclaimers. So is this kind of like your firm's standard signature disclaimer block that you have in all your email communications?
It is. And
that's prudent to do for a lot of reasons, right? Like, you know, you hold yourself out to the world. You're careful about how you do it. If you have a general counsel or an outside counsel, they say, hey, you ought to do this. And then you do it to protect yourself, right?
Yes, Judge. And that's we do that. And it's important to note that the problem with the judge's ruling, too, and on page 3 of 5 of the ruling, it actually states where the trial judge said she found that language to be boilerplate, so it meant nothing.
Well, okay. Well, let's. You're right, and we can talk about that. We've got 20 minutes. I want to talk about the subscript you were focusing. You were just reading it to us. I want to talk about that.
Okay.
So this is a standard thing your firm does in its emails as a general practice, right?
Yes.
Okay. So here's my curiosity. So, what do you do? I guess your firm does family law, right?
Well, yes, we do a lot of family law.
So your firm does enter into Rule 69 agreements, right?
Frequently and hopefully in most cases, yes.
Sure. So if this is your standard thing, and like you already said, you put it on all your emails, does that mean that every time you're having an email negotiation, you purport to disclaim away everything you're offering and all your Rule 69 offers? Like, how's that work?
Well, and let me just read the other, and I will answer that. So in there, there's not only that block, but there's also the other block that says that the signature is for informational purposes. So my practice, and I think it's a lot of practice of family law attorneys, is we put this language in there to protect ourselves because mm-hmm. clients do, and I think it's even in some of the notes or some of the discussion about that Rule 69, clients do change their mind. And so we send out communication like we did here and said, look, and actually the language in the actual email itself said, after multiple conversations with Justin, he has authorized me to make the following response or counteroffer. Then it says at the very bottom, if you don't agree on certain things, then we are willing to reach a 69 agreement.
I'm sorry, I just want to follow up. So are you saying that this language is included to allow your client to make an offer and then back out after it's been accepted?
No. It's a proposal. It's a proposal to start. This isn't intended, and that's why it says, this is intended to do the Rule 69 agreement. And there's two parts to add to that also. The other portion about a Rule 69 that we think is important and why we put this language in here, because if we have this language and we say this is the Rule 69, that can lead to issues like a client saying, well, I didn't know what I was doing. I wasn't informed. So in our Rule 69 agreements, when we do these, and there was actually a Rule 69 entered on the day of the hearing that was in writing and signed by the parties. And usually those will include language that says that I have done this knowingly, voluntarily, without threat, duress, coercion.
The problem with that, counsel, because everybody who represents private clients in contract law makes offers of contracts. At some point, you have to get your client's permission before you make the offer that has terms in it. You're sort of saying it's necessary for some reason that you should always be able to walk back offered terms. But do you understand our trouble with this, that you know, you have a disclaimer that basically turns a perfectly concrete offer with perfectly specified terms into something that can't really be accepted? That doesn't make sense.
Well, and I understand that, but it does allow to be offered, because what we do is we turn this into a formal written document that has a caption on it that says Rule 69, that says here's what the parties agree to. They're doing this knowingly, voluntarily, without threat, duress, coercion. They're doing it after advice of counsel or knowingly waive the right to do so. If we're dealing with child support issues, usually there's a line in our Rule 69 that says this agreement on child support is consistent with the guidelines or is an appropriate deviation to that.
Counsel, can I ask you, do you actually consider this an offer? Is this an offer?
Yeah.
Even though it later says that it's not an offer.
It's an offer to say, look, if we can agree on these things, we're going to do a Rule 69. And that's the way it's intended.
Well, so is it an offer or is it an offer to make an offer?
Well, it's an offer to enter into a Rule 69 agreement.
I think your disclaimer is ineffective as a matter of law, counsel, because it should have said this doesn't constitute an offer. It says it doesn't constitute an agreement. Per force, an offer is not an agreement, so I'm not sure what legal effect it could have.
Well, and that's why we're here today.
Sure.
Right. And so if this court determines that that language is inappropriate, then everybody's going to change their language. Or what I will probably do is I'll just stop signing emails, because then there's no signature to it. Or I'll go back to, we're just going to do phone calls, because then we don't have to get into these issues. And then I'll do a phone call to the other attorney, and then I can't do them, send out emails like this, trying to get the issues resolved at late at night or early in the morning or at other times.
Can I clarify one thing? Is your argument just based on that language of this is not a Rule 69 agreement, or is it also based on the part of your language that says it's not my the signature block is not my signature?
It's actually both. Okay. Not that it's not my signature, but again, the specific language is the purpose of this signature block is information only. The signature block does not constitute a signature for purpose of a signed agreement.
Okay. But in your offer, you did just sign it with your name, right?
Well,
before
there was
the signature block, right?
Yeah. So right underneath that, I just put, thank you, Mike.
And do you think that doesn't constitute your signature,
well,
the mic?
I don't believe
block.
It does, because of the signature block and the other line there that says that this communication does not constitute a Rule 69 agreement.
Well, I just want to parse it out a little bit. So the signature block, according to that language, is not your signature. But is there a reason that you typing in your name is not your signature? Besides reference to that disclaimer?
No, there's not. I was just being a little informal.
I'm just wondering if there's any other law that I'm not aware of.
No, and there isn't that I'm aware of. I was being a little less informal. I've known Mr. Hope for quite a few years. We've had a lot of cases together. We're on a first-name basis. I think I've even got his cell phone. He's got mine, so we can try to settle cases. So I just said, thank you, Mike. But again, that language, clearly from the language of the email, this was not intended to be a Rule 69 agreement that would be binding. We could then take this, if there was an agreement, which there wasn't an agreement on all the terms, we could then take that, whatever the agreement is, put it into a formal Rule 69, have the parties sign it. I don't personally, other attorneys may, I don't sign Rule 69 agreements on behalf of my client. I tell them to sign that, because then at that point, they are doing it fully aware, knowing, hey, if I sign this, this is going to be binding and I'm bound by that.
What about what Judge Jacobs was saying, that this is an offer? So of course it's not a Rule 69 agreement. So how doesn't that mean that when Mother's counsel accepted it, then it became an agreement? There's nothing in Mother's counsel's email saying this is not a, this is not an acceptance for purposes of Rule 69. I guess I'm kind of, you know, this was an offer. You don't say this is not really an offer. You say this is not a Rule 69 agreement, which of course it's not, because it's an offer. So I'm wondering how that all works, because to me that doesn't quite make sense.
I can understand that. But if you also look at the last line of that, the email from October 30th, if your client does not agree with item number 5, Justin is willing to reach a Rule 69 agreement on the other items. So it's very clear this isn't a rule. If she would have accepted all these terms, I think they would have had a better argument. But these terms weren't all accepted.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. I don't mean to second guess your approach to this, because you have a disclaimer and your disclaimer is important to you and you've explained reasons why. If I were you, I might have argued instead that, well, my disclaimer showed I was making an offer to make an offer, like an offer to discuss terms. And look, the response says we have an agreement in principle, which sounds like they understand that it's not really an agreement. It's like an agreement to reach an agreement, if you will. That seems consistent with your argument. But the only thing you're arguing to us is that your disclaimer controls. You're not really arguing the content of the response reinforces that, right?
Well, and I'm not, even though I did have that in my notes, that of the language you just used, because really at the trial court level, what did the judge do? She basically said, your boilerplate language is useless. It has no weight on there. And so really, again, this is, and I know it seems like a minor issue, but this really is a big issue for practitioners, I believe, because whatever decision you make is going to, if you decide to uphold the trial court's decision, it's going to affect, I believe, how practitioners do Rule 69 agreements or these type of communication. And so, like I said, either I'm going to go now and not put my signature on it, or I'm going to be putting other language in there, boilerplate language, though, that says this is not an offer. This is just a proposal to start discussions, and all that language just to protect myself more on that. Because in this case, and what happened was, my client, after we sent this proposal and response and counteroffer, he then came back in a short period of time and said, I've changed my mind. I'm going to move up there. I want to spend more time with my kids, and I don't want to have that agreement. And my response to him is, great. That's good for everybody, and we don't have a Rule 69.
Let me ask you another question. What if it had been the other party that had decided not to go through with the agreement? Could you have filed a motion to enforce this agreement?
I believe I could on them, because their communication did not include that language.
But yours did.
But
offer and acceptance
did.
Is required in contract. You need a mirror of an offer that's a valid offer, but you're claiming to have disclaimed away that it was an offer. So how could you then enforce it?
And that would be another argument. But there clearly was an enforceable. So hypothetically, with that type of analysis, then if I send an offer and they don't even respond, but they just file with the court that we have a Rule 69 agreement and put it in there, there was no, hey, acceptance, except for there was to the court, hey, we have a binding agreement against them. I mean, obviously, they're accepting it in principle. But to say that I can't enforce it against them, even though they say they are. Now, we didn't try to enforce anything against them. They were trying to force it against my client.
You don't dispute that the terms of what you set forth in your October 30th email contain all of the elements of a valid offer, right? They're sufficiently specific that the terms can be identified and enforced, right?
Yes, there would be.
It contains all the terms of an offer.
It contains enough terms of the offer to know what it is pursuant to some of the case law on this.
So you're saying that we made a proposal that includes all the terms of a valid offer. However, because we include this disclaimer that says this offer is not an offer, you deprive it of effect.
That is correct for the purposes of the email communication until we do it in a formal document and I have my client sign it. I know some attorneys may sign it on their own, but that being the difference, my client would sign this, and at that point, it would be binding.
All right. Well, your disclaimer doesn't say anything about we need to reduce this to writing, signed by the parties, et cetera. Your disclaimer doesn't say that. Your disclaimer simply says this communication is not a Rule 69 agreement.
Correct. Plain and simple. They would know, anybody from reading this is going to know this isn't a Rule 69.
Agreement.
Correct. It's binding on the parties and then ultimately accepted and would be binding on the court upon acceptance. So this is about whether this writing is binding on my client. It's clear from this that it is not, because it is saying this is not a Rule 69 agreement.
But you just said a minute ago you could enforce it.
Because their response to us was, we accept these. So under your scenario, could I have tried to enforce it against them? I believe I could, because their communication did not clarify that their response was not creating a Rule 69.
I don't want to spend too much more of your time on this, but I'm really puzzled by the contradiction between a claimed reservation that this can't be contractual, it's not really an offer, even though it has all the terms, to use Judge Kiley's words, it has no effect, but that you could enforce it after that. I don't think those things can both be true at once, counsel.
And then we would get into contract law. Well, if I can't afford, they can't enforce against me, I can't enforce it against them.
Right, I thought that was your position.
Right, but yes. Your question to me was, mm-hmm. is it binding on them? And mm-hmm. if we look at the rule, yeah, it's in writing. Mm-hmm. It was signed by her attorney that says, we accept this. My language and my email was, this writing that I'm sending to you is not a enforceable agreement on there.
Are you aware of any case law that says that a disclaimer in and of itself is enough to prevent a contract from?
I do not. And again, I've looked at and cited the cases, you know, Murray's. Murray actually was, you know, before the change of the rule, but it basically laid the premise that email communication can be an agreement. That can be writing. Text message can be writing, technically, if it's signed. How we determine the signature and that may be another issue. Ernst is the 2021 that talks about the electronic signature on that. There's a couple other cases that just kind of affirm those points, but I'm not aware of any case where it's been discussed of, does that disclaimer then not create a Rule 69? That's why your decision, I'm going to go to the CLE by the sea here this weekend. I would guess next year, CLE by the sea, this case will probably be there on practice tips of what to do or what not to do.
So, would you like to reserve the remainder?
I'll reserve just those couple of minutes.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, attorney Zach Hope with the law firm Aspie Watkins and Diesel, appearing for the appellee, Christina Weber. Judges, what we have here today is a buyer's remorse case. We have a case where an offer was made by counsel, that offer was then accepted, and then days later, not at the time the offer was accepted, but days later, an email was sent reneging on the terms of the agreement that was reached between the parties. When the court's looking at whether the trial court abused its discretion here in determining that the email communication between counsel did in fact create a binding agreement, the court should look at two things. First is Rule 69 of the Arizona Rules of Family Law Procedure, and second is underlying foundational principles of contract law. Pursuant to Rule 69, an agreement can be binding, and in fact is binding, if parties...
Can I stop you one quickly?
Sure,
one
sure.
Is standard review abuse of discretion or de novo?
I think it's a... Well, Judge, I think it's an abuse of discretion as it pertains to... Let me say this differently. I think it's de novo as it pertains to the court's analysis of the application of the rules of procedure in this case. I think arguably an abuse of discretion comes into play when we're talking about principles of parenting time, legal decision making, and so I do think that the court's application here applies a little bit to both.
What about the creation of a contract?
I think as it pertains to the creation of a contract, Judge, I do believe that's de novo. Thank you. Now, when the court's looking here to determine whether or not this agreement was in fact or should in fact be considered binding, again, the court should look at Rule 69 first, I believe. Pursuant to Rule 69, an agreement is binding if it is in writing or can be binding. There's different aspects that can make a Rule 69 agreement binding, but the one that applies here today is an agreement is binding if it's in writing and it's signed by the parties. What we have is two emails, one sent by father's counsel to my office on October 30th of 2025. That offer included various terms pertaining to various items at issue. The ones that we're addressing here today pertain to parenting time and legal decision making.
What about his argument that his signature isn't a signature?
Judge,
under Rule 69A1.
Sure. I think there's two different items there that the court should consider. First is that there are two signatures. One is the automatic signature block. The other is the second electronic signature that was included there. This is something that was addressed during argument previously, but I also think it's disingenuous to make an offer, regardless of whether there's a boilerplate disclaimer, an offer that clearly outlines terms of an agreement, and to then argue that, well, it shouldn't actually be binding because there's a boilerplate disclaimer included therein, Judge. But really, I think the court should be looking at the fact that there were two electronic signatures there. And then if you look at the acceptance from my office to Father's Counsel's office, again, a written email and an electronic signature that then satisfies the requirements of Rule 69 agreement.
But your response said you had an agreement in principle. That suggests to me that it's not.
I appreciate that question, Judge. As I indicated, there were a number of items that were addressed in the offer and in the acceptance. Looking at the offer specifically, while parenting time and legal decision making were addressed, and in the responsive offer, my office clearly indicated that decision making and parenting time would remain as is, and that my client agreed to that. There were other issues addressed in this correspondence pertaining to, for example, spousal maintenance. If you look at the spousal maintenance offer that was raised in the email sent October 30th of 2025 and the response that I sent on October 31st, 2025, again, yes, I first state that we have an agreement on principle or in principle on all issues other than the driver's license issue. I state that my client agrees that parenting time and legal decision making will remain as is. If you look two sections down as we address spousal maintenance, there's a specific provision there. To avoid the risk of ongoing litigation relating to this issue, she being my client, would like for this provision to be non-modifiable unless she satisfies the above notice obligation regarding employment, et cetera. There were some additional provisions not relating to parenting time, not relating to legal decision making, that I proffered to resolve other underlying issues pertaining to these other items. But again, as it pertains...
So it's not a mirror image. So it's not a perfect acceptance of the offer. Even assuming it's an offer and you ignore all of his disclaimers, you didn't mirror image accept it.
The provision of spousal maintenance, that is correct.
Right. Or the fifth one. You carved out the fifth one. So driver's license were not, so there's ones off. Then you have four, and you mirror image three but not four.
That is correct, Judge.
So that's why you're calling it in principle, because you're recognizing that there's some play in the joints.
As it pertains to issues beyond the scope of parenting time and legal decision-making, that is correct, Judge.
Okay.
And the other elements were the subject of another Rule 69.
That is correct. Agreement. To provide some context on the history here, because I don't know if it's clear, when the parties proceeded to the evidentiary hearing to address these issues, because counsel, based on the email communication that we've discussed, as well as I think the follow-up email on November 3rd indicating that father actually intended to now renege on the terms pertaining to parenting time and legal decision making, counsel agreed that we would reserve the enforcement issue pertaining to parenting time and legal decision making pertaining to that agreement, that we would present oral argument at the final trial relating to those issues, and that we would proceed to formalize in writing the other items so that those wouldn't be at issue. Again, reserving the right to argue that the parenting time and legal decision-making agreement had been reached.
And do you think, I mean, it seemed like the Superior Court kind of said that boilerplate language meant nothing. Do you agree with that?
As it pertains to the agreement, I do, Judge. I see this offer, the offer sent on October 30th, 2025, as being a mechanism for one party to essentially cross their fingers behind their back, say that they're offering something that could be accepted, and then after the fact, to be able to retain the right to renege on that offer.
What? Except he did it right in front of you. See, that's, your metaphor is a good one, but it's just, as a good advocate, it's just a little bit too generous to your position, because he did it right in front of you, and you didn't say, hey, I accept your offer, notwithstanding your ineffective intended disclaimer. You could have done that. That might have been clearer. And then you say agreement in principle, to Judge Fabian's questions point. So I think you left a little bit of scotia in the joints that you could have taken out at the time, no?
Judge, I think that given the offer and the acceptance, if it was truly the father's intention for this to not be an agreement, when the acceptance email was sent on October 31st saying, we have an agreement, my client agrees that parenting time and legal decision making will remain as is, that would have been the time for father's counsel to say, my apologies, we don't have an agreement. Please see the boilerplate disclaimer that I included in my offer. There is no agreement.
When you get the offer, do you notice that there's that boilerplate language?
I'm so sorry, Judge. Can you say that again?
Yeah, when you first got that offer, did you notice there was that boilerplate language?
Judge, I did not read that boilerplate language when I received that offer. I saw an offer that included specific detailed terms that I believed was a binding offer. I took that as being a binding offer that my client, through me, then accepted.
Okay. So I want to ask you a really tricky question.
Sure.
That is more to help us than at your position
sure.
to sort of cross-examine your argument. If we decide that the only issue raised in his brief is whether the disclaimer as a matter of law gets him out of the agreement, if we think that's all he's arguing, and I don't think you really have an agreement because you say agreement in principle and it's not mirror, as a judge, what do I do with that? Am I able to decide that there's no agreement, or am I stuck with only deciding the narrow issue he raised?
Thank you, Judge. I believe that, if I may pull that apart in a little bit here, I believe that the court can determine whether or not there was an enforceable contract here. I believe that pursuant to, well, in response to the court's question regarding the language that we had an agreement in principle. Again, Judge, I would ask the court to consider the fact that there were other provisions here, other terms beyond the scope of the parenting time and legal decision making. And again, that language, the agreement in principle language, specifically pertained to those other terms where there was back and forth. The agreement
so
regarding.
Are you saying that if one party says, I make an offer, here's my offer, A, B, C, and you come back and say, I accept A and B, C, I'm not so sure about. You're saying that that's a valid acceptance of A and B. You can parse out the other person's offer and leave out the terms that you don't like and accept the terms you do.
Here I think you can, Judge, and if I may explain. The agreement reached regarding the spousal maintenance was an agreement. My client proposed additional terms pursuant to the spousal maintenance issue, but she did agree to the portion of the Rule 69 agreement. A portion of the offer, rather, specifically relating to the spousal maintenance. So while she proposed an additional term regarding that, she did not indicate that she wasn't reaching an agreement. In fact, she indicated that she was. And Judge, I would also clarify that in the responsive offer, again, if you look at that email dated October 31st, 2025, first you'll see my client agrees that parenting time and legal decision making will remain as is. Then if you go down, my client will agree for spousal maintenance to be reduced to $3,600 per month for the remainder of the term, et cetera, to avoid the risk of ongoing litigation relating to this issue, she would like for this provision to be non-modifiable. She didn't say it must be. She didn't say it was required that it would be. We indicated that we would like for it to be. And so, again, I think that's an important distinction here, Judge, that, again, we were reaching an agreement on all terms set forth in this offer, but for the final term pertaining to the driver's license. If you look at the initial offer.
And let me just go back to Judge Jacob's question. Is the issue that we have to address whether the disclaimer language in the email as a matter of law prevents the formation of a valid contract? Or is the issue for us to address, was there a valid contract?
I think the issue here, based on the briefs that were filed, was does this disclaimer negate the effect of the offer? I do think that it would be I do think the court should address both issues if the court is able, and I think the court is. I think when the court's looking at the appeal that was filed, I think the issue of whether the disclaimer negates the legal nature or the binding effect here, I think that was the issue that was raised on appeal. But whether or not the underlying agreement is in fact binding, I do think that it is an issue that should be addressed.
Could we say that it is entailed by the first issue? The second issue is entailed by the first issue from your point of view?
I think it is, Judge.
Thank you.
So your position is we should address whether or not this email exchange created a valid agreement?
I do, Judge, as it pertains to the issues of parenting time and legal decision-making, not as it pertains to the other issues, because, again, I think the issues before this court specifically pertain to that parenting time and legal decision-making. I think those are the issues at dispute in the contract that is on appeal, that we are addressing on appeal here today. Judges, I'd ask you to look at, when considering the offer, when considering the responsive email, and when we're looking at, again, Rule 69, sure, but also these underlying principles of contract law, I ask that you look at whether an objective party here or an objective person would have considered this to, in fact, be an offer that could be accepted. The first email was an offer. It wasn't an agreement in and of itself. It was an offer that was made to counsel, and that offer was accepted. Looking at the first email, again, specifically
can a Rule 69 agreement that concerns children, parenting time, legal decision-making,
sure,
can that be created, validly accepted by the court without any kind of inquiry into whether it's in the children's best interest? Shouldn't the court at least have asked the parties to confirm it's in the children's best interest before adopting it?
I think that would be more of an issue here, Judge, if we were in a situation where the court had not already made findings pertaining to the best interest of the children. The agreement that, again, was offered and accepted was for parenting time and legal decision-making to remain as is. As is. The court had previously entered findings. The court had previously entered rulings regarding parenting time and legal decision making. That came up on appeal with the Division I Court of Appeals, and this court found that the Superior Court had entered findings regarding those issues, specifically finding that, I'm sorry,
I understand what you're saying, that this is a modification, it's not the establishment
Correct.
Of parenting time. So the court's already found that the parenting time schedule was in the children's best interest, et cetera. However, we all know circumstances can change. And that's what the modification proceeding was about. Before the transcript of the hearing shows that before the court accepted the Rule 69 agreement regarding spousal maintenance, the court addressed the parties personally and said, is this fair and equitable? There was no similar colloquy with regard to the provisions of this agreement regarding children. And it seems odd to me that before a court accepts a Rule 69 agreement about money, the court doesn't inquiry to make sure it's fair and equitable. But when we're talking about children, the court just skips that step and signs off on it.
Judge, I'm not aware of any statute, any case law that would require the court, in the context of not modifying parenting time and legal decision-making, to again make a finding that not modifying parenting time or legal decision-making pursuant to an agreement of the parties would require such a finding. Again, I think this would be different if this was the initial time that orders were entered. But the parenting time and legal decision-making here were not changed. We're not changed at all.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
Because I'd like to understand more about the subject Judge Kiley is raising, and I don't have familiarity with the first appeal. But were the findings made before consistent with both parents being fit parents and the spending of time with both of them being in the child's best interest? Were those findings made in the original order that was not being modified here?
Correct, Judge. In fact, what I think the court initially found, and what the Court of Appeals on, when addressing the initial trial court ruling found, was that substantial evidence supports the Superior Court's finding that it is in the younger children's best interest for mother to continue their homeschooling education. The court did not abuse its discretion by awarding an unequal parenting time schedule. That was a finding made by the Court of Appeals in response to the trial court's ruling, in which it found that an equal parenting time schedule would not be in the best interest of the child, and then went on to enter substantial findings and orders regarding the best interest, regarding parenting time, regarding legal decision making. And so, again, if this was initially the first time that the trial court was making rulings, absolutely. I think case law and statutory framework require the court to consider the best interest to specifically make findings regarding the best interest of the child. But there was no modification here.
It just seems puzzling to me because the purpose of the modification, both parties were seeking a modification of legal decision making. Both parties were saying the current arrangement is not working for the children. And for them both to just to agree to keep the current arrangement that they both said was not working, it seems puzzling to me that the court can accept that without personally addressing the parties and saying, you're asked to modify for the benefit of your children, now you're walking back that request. Is the status quo really in your children's best interest? It just seems very odd to me that the court would not ask that question. Is there anything more you can say about that?
Judge, I would just note that being odd that the court wouldn't address that, I don't think negates the legal or binding effect of the court's ruling or of the agreement reached by the parties. Specifically, the legal decision-making issue raised by my client and mother pertained to the driver's license issue that ultimately was addressed through litigation. The request for a modification of parenting time and legal decision-making, that was raised by father's counsel in their petition to modify, that is the request that they agreed to withdraw, and pursuant to that agreement to withdraw and the agreement to, again, maintain the current status quo for parenting time and legal decision-making, the court adopted that. I do agree, judges, that the court did not specifically on the record state that agreeing to maintain the status quo was in the best interest of the children. I think it was implied, but I don't think that was on the record. I've reviewed the record extensively.
So, and just to clarify, you believe the issue, this appeal presents the question of does the parties' exchange of emails in October give rise to a binding agreement, a valid contract under rule, or valid agreement under Rule 69, and that's an issue that we reviewed de novo.
I believe that's correct, Judge. I do have just a couple more minutes, if I may, judges. Judges, a reasonable person, I think, looking at the emails, again, on October 30th, the email that was sent in the responsive email on October 31st, would see the first statement indicating my client, this was the email sent by Mr. Ellsworth, my client has specifically authorized the following counteroffer. The acceptance to that, the email from my office sent a day later, specifically indicate my client agrees to maintain the status quo. I want to say it clearly and correctly, Judge, so I will present the language as set forth in that email. My client agrees that parenting time and legal decision-making will remain as is. There was no ambiguity. There was no confusion in the offer that was made or in the acceptance that was made to that offer as it pertained to parenting time and legal decision-making. If there had been confusion, if there had been ambiguity, then I think that the disclaimer, the standard disclaimer language, or this boilerplate disclaimer language indicating that the signature, one of the two signatures in the email from Mr. Ellsworth to my office, that negated any binding nature or binding effect of the agreement would hold more water here. But there was no ambiguity. There was no confusion. The offer specifically set forth terms. Those terms were specifically agreed. So, again, we are asking the court to affirm the trial court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Counsel, can you first begin by addressing the question I raised and Judge Kiley followed up on as to whether we are addressing only the legal effect of the disclaimer or whether we are addressing the sort of related or barnacled on question of whether there is a contract at all?
Well, based on what we filed in our appeal, it's just the language in the disclaimer. That's all the only issue we raised on appeal with that.
So you believe that's the only issue before us?
That's, I believe, is the only issue before this court.
Right.
I mean, if we look at the practicality of this, the trial court's ruling, by the time now we get through the appeal and get back and get a ruling, we're going to be close to a year and we can go file a petition to modify parenting time anyways. And that's just the nature of what happens, you know, in these cases. But I think it's important, again, to know going forward is, can we put that language in there, or are we going to have to change how we do these? And Judge Kiley, in regards to your question about the best interest finding, the case of Murray, I think, has a lot of good language regarding that. And just a couple things from that. It does cite in there, and this is citing the Nanderson case from 1971, where it says the court, independent of any stipulation or agreement of the parties, must be convinced that the best interest and welfare of the minor children will be advanced by that. And it talks about some others. So I do believe that the trial court has to make an independent finding of best interest, even when accepting the agreement of the parties. But I think.
But is that an issue that's being raised?
It's not. I'm just raising that because you had asked opposing counsel about it, and it's something that. But it's not. But I also know, just on that note, that I believe there's some language, and I couldn't find it, that the kind of the presumption is, if the parties are entering into this agreement, and they're stating that as a Rule 69 agreement, the presumption would be there. But I want to note on our issue, as noted, at the bottom of the first email from Thursday, October 30th, it does state, if your client does not agree with item number 5, Justin is willing to reach, and that word reach is in there, a Rule 16 agreement on the other items in lists 1 through 4, which again is consistent with, this isn't a Rule 69 agreement, but we are willing to reach one. That then does not bind my client and allows him to come back and say, look, I've changed my mind. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for their excellent arguments. They're very helpful to the court. We will take the matter under advisement and get a decision out as soon as we can. We're adjourned.